You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. And we are back. Tracy, I hope you've had a good couple of weeks. We have a great guest today, and Stephen Blackmore. And he just reminded me, we've had him on in the past.
Yes. And
long time
God
ago.
Knows why you let me back on.
Well, because Tracy vouched for you.
You clearly cannot trust her judgment.
No, you really can't.
So, for the benefit of our listeners, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Okay. I am Stephen Blackmore. I am an author of fantasy science fiction, mostly urban fantasy. I have an urban fantasy series, about a modern day necromancer in Los Angeles. Fifth book just came out, and that one is, oh my God, I forgot the name of my book. That one's called Ghost Money. And there are four more, and I've got four more coming.
So what you're saying is that the genre is not dead.
I would say the genre is not dead.
Get it?
Necromancer book, death joke. Oh, yeah. He's never heard that. He's never heard that at all.
So what's the premise of the series without spoiling everything?
The premise is that it's a world with it's a fairly recognizable urban fantasy world. There are mages, there are various monsters, and so on. The dynamics of which are probably not all that surprising to anybody. But the character, I think, is more of a take on the typical UF protagonist I hadn't seen before. It's definitely very noir, in the Reservoir Dog sort of way, rather than the Big Sleep sort of way. It's extremely violent. There's a lot of swearing. There's things go poorly. You know, Eric is a necromancer, and after killing the man who murdered his parents, he left Los Angeles because it had pretty much painted a target on his back and all of his friends and family who are still around. So he left after that. 15 years later, he finds out that his sister has just been murdered back in Los Angeles. And she being the main reason that he stayed away, he goes back to find out what exactly happened. So his journey, I guess, just through the books in general, is kind of coming to terms with the damage he left behind and the things that are now consequences for him. So there's a lot of, there is a big focus on consequences. a friend of mine described noir really well, and I think it fits with this. It's good intentions, bad ideas, terrible consequences. And this this definitely is the direction that I try to take it.
One question I wanted to ask you, Stephen, and we talked about this a little bit in the setup period before we got into recording the episode, is, you know, people tend to talk a lot in the world of publishing about there being waves or trends of things that get published, and there's a lot of excitement from consumers and from readers, and then there turns into a glut of that stuff, and then the industry, at least temporarily, kind of turns its back on that particular subgenre. Everybody wants zombies, nobody wants zombies. Everybody wanted vampires. Nobody wants vampires, except now we're getting a retelling of Twilight from the perspective of Edward, because sure. And
because
so
because money. Money.
Yeah, I mean, you're way less nice than I am, but you're way more accurate. So what I'm getting to here is, as someone who's writing an urban fantasy, which arguments have been made back and forth about whether or not it's sort of like overdone or not overdone, and there's a certain guy with a funny hat and a stick whose character's in Chicago, who is kind of
I can't imagine who you're talking about.
I'm talking about Dumbledore. It's Dumbledore. Yeah. But anyway, we've got this genre that has a very specific sort of market to it and very specific iconic characters and things. What is it that you're striving to do as a writer of your own urban fantasy series to put your own mark on it and to make sure that you've got your own corner of the urban fantasy world to write from?
Well, the short, probably most accurate one is I want to tell the stories that I want to tell. And more importantly, I like swearing a lot. So, you know, I'm going to put that in the books. So that's a big thing for me. A little more pretentiously, I think I'm trying to write urban fantasy that's a little more adult.
Okay.
There are a few good endings. Just something that can be... There's very little of any kind of romantic subplots. They're very action thriller oriented, and nobody is a good person. And Eric, frankly, he's probably the worst of the lot of the people in that are in these books. It really comes down to these are the kinds of stories that I want to tell, and that's really all there is.
So Tracy, you talked a little bit about the ebbs and flows of publishing and the different, you know, like what's hot now,
yeah.
Right? Have either of you ever seen the movie, the Beatles movie, A Hard Day's Night?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to have to repeat that. I didn't hear you.
Have you ever seen the Beatles movie, A Hard Day's Night?
Oh, forever ago, but yeah.
So there's a great scene in there where they all go off on their own and George ends up in a marketing office and is quickly ushered into a meeting because of the way he's dressed and the way he looks, and the secretary thinks he looks great. So she takes him into this meeting where they are showing him clothes. They're showing him all the stuff and he hates it all. And they're like, well, you're not going to hate it because this girl that we have on TV is going to be wearing this stuff and you're going to be ostracized if you don't have it, if you don't wear it. And he goes, oh, that's the girl we don't like. You know, the lads and I, we turn the sound down and watch her and say nasty things. The point being, she's a trendsetter, right? It's a marketing ploy. She's a trendsetter. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea behind all the clothes and everything that's popular at the time, and they were poking fun at this, is that there were these people who are basically paid to be celebrities and whatever they are endorsing is something they're paid to endorse, and it's setting a trend. I've often felt that publishing does a very similar thing, because I tried for years to sell an urban fantasy when urban fantasy was hot, and I kept getting told, well, we're not buying urban fantasy right now. We've got enough. Right. So we're trying something else. Now we're looking for, do you have XYZ? Do you have a space opera? Do you have a epic fantasy? Do you have a blah, 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 blah? Because what we're looking at is the calendar 18 months out when we think that this is what's going to be hot. I think that flows based on a couple different things. I think that they decide. They're like, we're getting an influx of this. This is what we think is going to be hot. So this is what we're going to push. And the other side of it is, well, George R. R. Martin's going to come out with a new book on X date. And so that's going to be the new hot thing. So we need to get as many different variations of that as possible going.
You know, I think anybody who tries to predict publishing or film trends, you know, something that's 18 months, 2 years out, 99% of them are wrong. You know, and it's that one who puts one thing out that grabs so much attention that others start jumping in.
Yeah.
You know, there are, God, I can't even remember the company. There's one of these B movie companies, kind of like the old Corman, film.
Yeah.
Okay. And what they do is they will take a popular, you know, the thing that's hot right now, and do a similar thing, and it'll be almost exactly the same title, mm-hmm. like with one different word.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of thing happens only if they look at that and go, we can make money here. You know, they don't want to, you know, and I think that's what happens a lot in general, probably, I don't want to say just publishing, but just sort of creation, not even creators so much, because we really aren't trying to follow a trend, I think, most of the time.
Yeah, we're all just kind of trying to make fetch happen and,
yeah, exactly.
and hoping that it's going to happen, I think is a way of describing it. My agent, who is Bridget Smith of Jabberwocky Literary, has a podcast called Shipping and Handling that she does with Jen Uden, who is also an agent, and she has recently moved to a different agency, and I am sorry, Jen, I can't remember what agency you're with now. And in Shipping and Handling, they tend to talk a lot about publishing and sort of the insider baseball of it and the implications of choice making and querying and all sorts of stuff there. To a certain extent, I think editors and agents are perceived as the influencers that you're talking about, Patrick. But I also think at the same time that like the what makes publishing and storytelling as like an industry so different from, I don't know, like YouTube influencer culture, you know, people who are going to hawk Fenty or, you know, Fluvogs or what have you, is that those are literally visible people. And that part of how the product gains its visibility is through those people. I think that publishing has a tendency to come off as more mysterious, even to the people who are inside the publishing machine, because the folks who are just trying to make fetch happen versus the folks who are the real influencers often don't know who each other are. I don't know if that as a comment.
No, tracks. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, if anybody is an influencer, it's going to be readers.
That's
and,
true.
And you know, the like I said, trying to make fetch happen. Most of the time, we don't. You know, I'm not doing anything particularly new. I'm doing it my particular way. But I've had a lot of comparisons made between my work and Richard Kadrey's and Jim Butcher's, you know, the John Constantine character, all these sorts mm-hmm. of things.
Yeah.
It's nothing new. And I think most of those situations, there is nothing new.
Which reminds me, if you have a necromancer in L.A., are we going to see a CW crossover between Lucifer, Constantine, and Eric?
You know, funnily enough, I've had one producer actually interested in talking to me about turning the series into television. And
nice.
I had a meeting, and it was horrible.
Knew
within 5 minutes, this is not going to happen. And basically wanted to turn it into kind of a monster of the week kind of thing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I find out later that he was one of the producers of Charmed.
Oh, okay.
And I went, oh, you know what? That actually seems to explain a lot. Just kind of had that vibe.
But, is it the old Charmed or the new Charmed?
Old.
Ah.
Yeah, the old one.
Well, and that's Formula TV, right? Monster of the Week. That's what they like.
Yeah.
It's easy. It's got an easy entry point. You don't have to follow the storyline.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to have any kind of meta plot, you know, throughout it, you don't have to worry too much about resolving it, provided that you keep each episode.
Yeah, like 21 or 24 episodes to kind of glancingly touch at, you know, the big bad, if there is one.
A great example of that is the Dresden TV file or TV show. They did that. Like they took the Dresden Files and they made it a Monster of the Week kind of shtick.
Oh yeah. Well, that was one of the things when I walked in there and my first thought is if he starts pointing in that direction, I'm just gonna leave. And sure enough, that's exactly what I was afraid of, that exactly happened.
The redeeming factor of that show, though, is that it brought so many people to the books.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess now I'm going to, this is not a devil's advocate move exactly, but I want to kind of push on this conversation a little bit, Stephen, because I'm really interested in what's going through your head as you're sitting in that meeting, hearing a description of your work back at you, where you just know this is not my work. And you know that there's a certain calculus there, right? Because just a couple minutes ago, you were saying that there was nothing new about what you're doing. But it's pretty clear that in your heart as a writer, you do feel that there is something that makes an Eric Carter book an Eric Carter book in the choices that you've made as a mm-hmm. storyteller. And to choose differently would make it not your work. And the integrity of that choice is important enough that walking away from the possibility of a television production, which, while it's going to water down or get rid of certain of those elements, maybe could lead to an influx of new readers or something else. That's a real choice, and it's a difficult one. So I kind of want to push back on this idea of like, sure, there is nothing new there, because clearly you were fighting for that thing when you made the decision to walk away.
And by nothing new, I mean a private eye novel is a private eye novel.
Sure.
You can have Philip Marlowe as one and Elvis Cole as another, and Jim Rockford is a completely different one. And none of them are the same, but they're all recognizable. And that I think is what we're all trying to do, is put our particular spin on an idea that has been told several times already. You hear constantly, you know, the private eye novel is dead. And, oh, hey, what? But, oh, here's another private eye novel. Oh, well, it's dead now. Oh, look, here's another one. You know, and I think you hear that with vampires, zombies, urban fantasy. So for me, when I say I'm not doing anything new, I guess it's more I'm not playing in a brand new sandbox.
But you're trying to build different kinds of sandcastles in it.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the things with the conversation that I had, knowing I live in LA, and so I tend to see this kind of I don't think I know anybody really who has not had a conversation with somebody that is in the movies out here. I mean, it's all connected, you know, everywhere, even, you know, tenuously. And I really wasn't worried that anything was going to happen, because nothing ever does. You get, option the book for this TV series. Yeah, that's great. And I don't expect it ever to be made. Mm-hmm. If it does, that's surprising and awesome sometimes. But not what usually happens.
You're just happy to see that down payment for the option come in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys saw the story a couple of years ago though, but they said that a lot of studios weren't optioning the book until they had developed it out. So they would just go, they would start developing and attaching people to it and kind of building out the project, and then would go and even sell it to someone, and then go and say, oh, by the way, we need to get the option on this.
Yeah.
So they were doing a lot of that first, and you would never even know that they're developing your book until someone came to you and said,
you know,
hey, we want the option.
If somebody gives you money.
Yeah.
The thing that really kind of did it for me with the conversation I had, the folk saint Santa Muerte and Aztec mythology gods and goddesses and sort of LA based aspects of those are a very key part of the series. And he looks at me and says, you know, with all these different gods and goddesses with these Aztec, you know, and this Santa Muerte, who's the villain. And I was like, well, it's not quite that simple. Yeah, but she's the villain and this, that's like, okay. I don't know if I could sell all that. What if we turned them into demons?
Oh, dear.
And I went, definitely not. Because, you know, just aside from the fact that it kind of goes against the grain of the world itself. But also, I really don't feel comfortable turning, clearly I'm okay with turning, you know, a religion into fiction, but right. Taking these icons and turning them into demons just bugs me.
Yeah, you don't want to reach into the bag of someone else's culture and say it is difficult to articulate and understand in my specific terms what your ideation is here, so I'm just going to call it all demons.
Right.
Yeah.
And particularly with the character of Santa Muerte, just I tried to do as much research as I could on her as an icon and her followers and all that. And you know, there's a sort of satanic panic thing going on when people see images of Santa Muerte and go, oh my God, that's the devil. It's like, yeah, no, not even close. And I wanted to make sure that vibe in particular was maintained. It's a key part of the story. It's a fascinating, for me at least, a fascinating phenomena of her as a figure and as a movement. And I just wouldn't want to lose that.
So my day job, I'm in academics. And so you just triggered my geek button there.
Uh-huh.
Tell me, Stephen, one of the cooler or more interesting things that you ran across in your research, which may or may not have ended up in the books. Like, I want to hear some research insider baseball.
She's a love sorceress.
Okay.
Okay. There's this thought, this view that she's death and she isn't. She's called upon for protection. She's called upon for romance. That's actually mostly what she was previously known for before, you know, the cartels kind of picked her up. And even they weren't taking it as, oh, she's death. It was more, Santa Muerte is going to protect me from death. You know, Santa Muerte is going to help me get revenge, is going to help me find love. She's going to do, you know, she's going to do those things that I cannot call on any other saint for. You can't call on St. Christopher and say, hey, could you knife this guy for me? You know, it doesn't really fit that way. And that complexity really was interesting, even to the point of how she's depicted is important. She's typically shown as a skeletal figure in a wedding dress with a scythe in one hand and a globe in the other. And depending on the color of the wedding dress, that's a particular focus. Red is love. White is protection. Black is, for lack of a better term, I guess, sorcery. she's the one you go to when all the chips are down, and this is not a deal with the devil kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, it's pray to Santa Muerte. You know, if I can get your favor, then great. But she's not okay. Now you need to sacrifice, 20 babies or something like that. Mm-hmm. But what she does demand is that you're fair. And I had someone I know who kind of grew up with her in Mexico, and the example she gave was somebody steals your pig. So you go to Santa Muerte and say, hey, I want revenge on this guy, and please help me. Well, she won't necessarily take revenge, but maybe what she'll probably do is give you your pig back. If you go around and turn and then go steal that other guy's pig, all bets are off because you broke the rules.
Okay.
You weren't fair about it, so now you reap the consequences. And that is just the whole character of her. The nuances are fascinating. There's a lot of stuff that I just really enjoyed learning about. She's mostly actually European, kind of a Spanish import.
Okay.
Excuse me. But she's also a syncretization between Catholic saints and indigenous death goddesses. So there's a big, not too likely, but there's a connection between her and Mictlantecuhtli, who's the Aztec goddess of death. And so you have all these different avenues and all these different branchings, and it's easy to just kind of follow one string and watch how it branches out into so many others. So yeah, she's just in general, she's a fascinating figure to me.
And apparently a character that runs throughout the books.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, she's a very important character throughout the books.
I love
good or ill.
Well, and I love what you've shared with it about, because it makes so much clearer that when you're talking about, the idea of the noir formula being like dark situations, bad choices, bad consequences, worse outcomes. The idea that you can have an interaction with a being like Santa Muerte, and it is in the context of the choices you made, maybe as a result of that interaction or as a result of that confrontation, things go bad. But it would be too simplistic to just say, well, it happened because she's the villain.
Yeah.
Yeah, which kind of comes back to the whole production angle and it looking dissatisfying.
Yeah, and I hate evil characters. They piss me off. Well, why is he doing this thing? Oh, because he's evil. There's got to be a little more to it than that. So she's an antagonist for a good part of the series, and she kind of is maybe an ally in various times throughout.
Mm-hmm.
But she has very clear goals, clear to herself. She doesn't necessarily share them. So she's, whatever she's doing it for a reason. And I wanted to make sure that, and continue going forward, that every character is doing something for a reason. You know, being a villain just for being a villain just annoys me to no end.
So it's like right there on the table. I can't not ask about it now. Give me an example of a villain character that other people get excited and geeked out about that you just don't have the time for. This is not what interests you about an antagonist.
Any Bond villain.
Okay.
Just that. they're, oh, well, it's vengeance. Okay, why? You know, or it's trying to think of, see, they all kind of fall out of my head because they're all the same thing.
It's Blofeld is the same. Blofeld, as,
exactly. Yeah. Like, okay, well, what do you really want? Well, it's power. Well, okay, you want to take over the world? What are you going to do with it when you get it? Why? Why are you doing this? And those things don't get addressed, I think. And a lot of that, I think, is, oh, particularly any World War II or Cold War sorts of stories, the villain is a villain when it's written by the other side. American espionage movies, well, the Russians are always the bad guys. Well, why were they bad? Because they're Russian, you know, and that's like all you really get there. And that, yeah, I don't like that whole, I'm going to demonize this thing because it's easy. That it feels lazy when that's done for a character.
Oh, I definitely understand what you mean, and this is coming as someone who, way younger than I should have, like I probably really should have been steered away from these choices. But my mom used to like to take me to a used bookstore when I was growing up. It was the Novel Idea, and it was in Woodridge, Illinois, which is not too far away from the town where I grew up, and it was one of those really cool used bookstores that was just sort of demi-organized, but mostly just like this zone of chaos. And you would go in, and I think the deal was like you would pay 40% of whatever the listed cover price was. So what you had to do if you were super smart is you would go, if you were into SF like I was, and you would buy like the 75-cent pulps and, you know, get them for even more stupidly cheap. But I ended up, as a result of one of those trips, getting a huge boatload of Ian Fleming era and John Gardner era Bond books. Okay, and I read through dozens of Bond stories from the time I was 10 until the time I was 13, which is just way too young to be reading Bond stories. Like, I have no idea, like, why is her name Holly Goodhead? Like, that seems strange. Pussy Galore?
That's like an odd name.
Yeah, that's interesting. But even that aside, like, the stakes would generally make no sense to me, because I would be like, I don't know what NATO is, or I don't know what these are. Like, whatever, I'm assuming that it's... And later, about 15 years later, I went back to one of the books just, you know, for giggles, and flipped through and started rereading parts of it, and I realized it actually did not matter that as an adult I now understood international mm-hmm. relations and things like that I had no access to or understanding of as a child, because even that knowledge informing my second read of that particular book, whichever one I grabbed, didn't change the fact that the first way I'd read the books was sufficient. Like, he's the bad guy because he's got a twirly mustache and because he's mean. Like, that was enough. It was always enough. And it was enough for 12-year-old me. When I came back to it later as like 27-year-old me, I was mightily displeased.
I can't imagine why.
Clearly, you are a great defender of that whole genre. All right, we are kind of getting to the phase of things where we hijack what has otherwise been a totally awesome and organic discussion to do some of the talking about standards that we do. And one of the standard things that we tend to do is a pick of the week. Patrick, are we still doing pick of the week music from time to time, or not so much?
Yeah, we can do pick of the week.
Hit the pick of the week button.
So before I do that, though, I do want to remind people that we have a Patreon account. It's at patreon.com/functionalnerds. So if you like what we do, go back us there, give us a few dollars, and we can continue doing great, great shows like this one with Steven. But yeah, as far as picks of the week, I do still have that music. So
picks of the week.
See, I'm all inspired now. I'm in the mood.
Yeah, you know, and this whole time was like, I gotta think of some, like, what? Oh, God, I gotta,
Here's what we can do. Here's what we can do. We can give you a second to think about it, okay? And Tracy will go first. We'll make her go first.
Yeah.
So, Tracy, do you have a pick of the week?
I do. People who follow me on Facebook may know that I recently sent out a plea into the ether saying, my daughter destroys television shows for me, because she's 8, and her pattern is she watches a show, almost always animated, falls in love with it. I watch it through with her the first time. She at least has decent taste. Like, they're very, very good programs. Like, she got into Gravity Falls. She got into the DuckTales reboot. She got into Avatar The Last Airbender. But then once she's watched it once, she will watch it 10 billion times. And it especially in the context of quarantine and me working from home for the last 7 weeks, trying to teach and to parent her and whatnot, has been totally crazy making. So I just had to cry out into the etherverse saying, please recommend me a new thing. Thank you very much, to addict my daughter to, so I can at least have like a couple weeks of novel things playing over and over again in the background of my life. And as a result of suggestions made by people, I started watching on Netflix, Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts, which came out late in 2019. There's just one season of it, 10 episodes long, so it's not a big time suck with like 22-minute long episodes and 10 of them. But it is a great example of what I like being done well in storytelling. It's just completely immersive. The first episode breaks that rule that you're supposed to follow of don't start with action, and that we start in this sort of dizzying circumstance of this character Kipo, who is literally washed out of a flooded sewer into the world above, and she has grown up in an area called the Burrow, which apparently is somewhat Fallout-like, where humanity has retreated to in the face of some wave of mutations that took place about 200 years earlier. And the wave of mutations have created redonkulous creatures out of the previously native flora and fauna of the world. And now somehow a flooding event disaster in the burrows has chucked her up into the surface world, and she has to get home. And so it's a wonderful fish out of water story. The animation is gorgeous. The voice acting is great. The writing is very savvy, both for kids and for the adults who may be watching with it. So I recommend Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts.
Very cool. Awesome. Steven, so does that give you an idea of what we're doing?
Yeah. So instead of going with what I originally was thinking, which was just to say antidepressants, which I still, you know, agree with.
Recommended strategies.
Because I'm looking at what do I have on my desk? Oh, hey, I've got antidepressants. But I also have Madame Clara's 5-Cent Tarot. And this is something my wife found on Kickstarter some time ago. And we just got the cards a little while ago. And they are all done in a, well, I don't even know how, a sort of Victorian, you know, the fortune telling machines where you'd have like Zoltar,
yeah. Right,
you know,
yeah,
you put a nickel like a in and yeah, you know, the machine moves around and spits out a fortune. And it's done like that.
Huh.
And the artwork is just amazing.
So you said it's a cent or cents? It like four.
5 cents. Five, a nickel. Yeah.
Oh, C-E-N-T-S. Okay. Like I was wrong, yeah, completely. There was a third one. So excellent. That's
very, I also wrote down sense as in the sense of touch. So I was right there with you, Tracy.
Okay, cool. Okay.
Yeah, so it is very impressive. It's a beautiful deck. Incredibly well made.
You're something of a connoisseur of tarot as well.
Well, I I don't know about connoisseur.
Well, you are.
I like.
You're an
I
innovator like of tarot. Galen Dara having done some cards.
Oh, the Lucaria cards, yeah, that I had. Yeah.
Galen did my book cover.
Oh, Galen's amazing.
Yeah, I've known her for a long time. She's awesome.
Yeah, I had I commissioned from her for the third book, and I had and still have plans on doing something with them. Instead of tarot, in my third book in Hungry Ghosts, there's a situation with, you know, fortune-telling cards, but instead they're using Loteria cards. And if I don't know if you're familiar or anybody's familiar with Loteria, it's like bingo. What you have is your card, and it has, I think, 20, 25 something pictures in different orders of cards. And the cards are drawn by the person who's who's running the Loteria game. And, you know, he'll say El Valiente and then read a little short thing about there's like each one has like a nonsense rhyme associated with it. And so I commissioned her to do five cards for five of the characters key to Loteria cards. And they're beautiful. They are just absolutely gorgeous. And I had some printed up and I gave some away for a giveaway. I've got all the artwork. I'm going to do something with them.
Listeners, if you want to see what Steven's talking about, you should go to his website, which is
stephenblackmore.com.
Highly intuitive. Blackmore ending with an E. And
two O's.
Yeah, and the PH Stephen. So you're going to be look at stephenblackmore.com, and those cards are up there, the images for them.
And yeah, the artwork's incredible. She also did, I had a short story in Fireside magazine a while back that features one of the characters from the books. And she did the artwork for that as well. And it was, like always, just stunning.
It's nice to have that continuity too.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm actually trying to do more of is to write other stories that takes place in the universe or connect in to the characters. There's actually, before the Eric Carter series, there was there's one called City of the Lost that I did, and that's the same universe prior to the Carter universe. He's not in it, and totally different, mostly different characters. But it also gives me something that I can refer back to as well. So I'm kind of like trying to build up a story world outside the novels that can supplement it.
That's great.
So I'm gonna go because we're running out of time. But my pick this week, I am well known for jumping on the bandwagon years, if not decades, after something happens, especially if it's a pay cable kind of TV show. I recently grabbed the Watchmen
Gilligan's Island
series. Nope, Watchmen from HBO, and have started watching that little buddy, and that was my Gilligan's Island thing. But I grabbed season one of Watchmen, and I'm a couple of episodes in. I saw so many people talking about how great a show that was that I decided when it hit Prime to just bite the bullet and buy it by the season. I started that, and I'm really enjoying it. It's pretty intense. It reminds me of, there's a lot of stuff out there now that's intense. Titans is pretty intense. The Boys, the Amazon Prime original, is pretty intense. I know there's a season two of that coming. This is a very intense show, but I'm enjoying it so far. So if you haven't checked that out yet, that might be worth it. I know, is it coming on HBO Max? Is that like their new thing? Is HBO Max? That's where they're going to put it. I don't know anymore.
Well, I know it's on what they've got, HBO Go. I know it's on HBO Now.
Yeah,
because I've seen the first episode, but hadn't gone further.
Yeah, I grabbed the whole season. So I tend to not buy extraneous streaming services.
Yeah.
Because they annoy me. So, like, DC's universe, I don't buy, but I just wait for their... So, I've gotten the two seasons of Titans and the first season of Harley Quinn all on Prime when they dropped there, and have enjoyed all of those. So, I just decided to get Watchmen, and I'm enjoying it. So, that's my recommendation this week. Awesome. Since we are running out of time, Steven, you already gave us your website. How about social media? Is there a social channel that you prefer that people can come follow you and...
Yes.
Interact.
You can find me on Twitter, at S Blackmore. Also very original.
Discoverability, man.
Discoverability. And I will sometimes rant about things that bother me, but as often as possible, I try to be funny. And come see me. Look at
yeah,
my stuff.
I prefer to be funny.
Buy my books.
I prefer to be funny. Yeah. Ghost Money just dropped, right?
Yep.
All right. And if people from hearing you talk at length about your extraordinarily researched, developed, dark and chewy world of noir in Los Angeles want to pick up on the Eric Carter series, where do they start? Give them the title of the first.
Dead Things.
Thank you. All right, folks. So we hope
Thank
that you find at your library as an ebook or in print a copy of Dead Things for yourself and for others in your life. Thanks so much, Functional Nerds.
Thank you.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Functional Nerds podcast. If you're looking for other great podcasts to listen to, I recommend Beyond the Trope. They premiere new nerdy episodes every week. Giles and Michelle have piled up over 7 years worth of interviews with best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community. And even though, they've sincerely disappointed me by not coordinating a meet and greet with every dog they know, their Patreon supporters and fans love them for keeping their weekly episodes short, sweet, and full of laughs. Check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a backer of the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have all new levels with some fantastic rewards like access to our patrons-only Facebook group, exclusive extra shows and content like the new video podcast, Just 10 Minutes, book giveaways, yep, we're giving away books, and even short story critiques provided by Tracy every month. If any of that sounds good to you, again, visit patreon.com/functionalnerds. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.